Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview our week ahead. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Joining me at the roundtable this week is Jesse Balmert, state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
Jake Zuckerman, state politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com. Hi, Jake.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And Noah Blundo, reporter and editor for Hannah News Service.
Good morning, everyone.
We have 1 week to go until Election Day, and we're going to get into all things election-related, but I want to begin by taking a moment to remember former Ohio House Speaker Joanne Davidson. Davidson was the first and so far only woman to become Speaker of the Ohio House. She died on Friday at the age of 97. Jesse, I suspect a lot of listeners might not know who Joanne was, but she was a force in Republican politics here in Ohio for decades, and a big part of the reason we had the National Convention in Cleveland in 2016. So can you give us a sense of her legacy?
Yeah, her legacy is tremendous. Obviously, she was a member of the Ohio House of Representatives, but before that, she was a city councilwoman. She also was an Ohio Chamber of Commerce lobbyist. She was instrumental in bringing the RNC to Cleveland in 2016, served as trustee of Ohio State and a number of other colleges. So, I mean, even until recent years, has just been very, very active behind the scenes in politics, particularly Republican politics. But I think one of the biggest parts of her legacy was the Joanne Davidson Institute, where she helped hundreds of women get involved in politics and public service, maybe not running for elected office, but getting involved in different community organizations. And you know, that's not something every politician does, you know, kind of lift as you rise kind of situation.
Senator Michelle Reynolds from the southern part of the Columbus region and the first Black woman Republican elected from Franklin County called Davidson a pivotal force and a change maker. She took that leadership institute back in the year 2000. Noah, I have kind of a tough question for you.
Okay.
Davidson is the only woman to be elected to the Big Three, which means the House, the Senate, and the governor. Now, we did have a female governor for 11 days, but she wasn't elected. That's a whole other story.
Nancy Hollister.
There we go. But when are we going to see a woman again, or a woman governor? I don't even think we've had a woman U.S. senator.
No, and it's just, you know, year to year, what the dynamics are and what the bench is and happenstance, and, you know, you got to be in the right place at the right time for a lot of things, and I don't know. I wouldn't want to put any money on when it will happen, but
yeah, Davidson said that was one of her regrets, that she got into politics too late to run for governor. Although, given the age of Mike DeWine, I do think we're redefining how old you have to be to run for statewide office or U.S. president these days.
Yeah, it's true. And Ohio is really one of a few states that has never elected a woman governor, never elected a woman U.S. senator. We have a number of women serving in the U.S. House of Representatives. Marcy Kaptur, who's in a quite competitive race in the Toledo area, is the longest serving woman in Congress. So you see women in different positions, but, you know, what will it take to get to these leadership spots?
Women have been, you know, vying for the ticket, at the top of the ticket in the last couple of cycles. On Mary Taylor ran as a Republican. After that, Nan Whaley ran. You know, it'll happen. It's just a matter of time and, you know, right candidate, right time.
The Democratic caucuses are both ran by women.
Yeah.
House Minority Leader Allison Russo and Senate Minority Leader Nikki Antonio.
One of who we could see on the ticket in 2 years.
Amy Acton is exploring a run for governor, maybe. We'll have to wait and see. Morgan Harper tried to run for U.S. Senate, didn't get out of the primary. So there's Jane Timken. There's been attempts, just never gotten there.
I will say, given the politics of the state, I think probably the first one will be a Republican woman.
Probably. Davidson's death wasn't the only news last week. Ohio's 6-week abortion ban was finally ruled unconstitutional. A Hamilton County judge determined that Ohio's heartbeat law violates the Reproductive Rights Amendment voters passed last year. Jesse, this is not the end of the story, so what happens next?
Yeah, it's possible that there's a going to be appeal. I myself haven't heard from the Ohio Attorney General's office on what their next steps are going to be, but this was the main law that was litigated last year when we were having a abortion rights amendment. It was a law that banned doctors from performing abortions after embryonic fetal heartbeat was detected, which could be as early as about 6 weeks into pregnancy. This law was in effect for about 82 days in 2022 after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. And it was the law that was kind of sending people to other states to obtain abortions. Most notably, on a national level, there was a 9 or 10-year-old who went to Indiana. So this was really the key law that people were thinking about when they were going to the ballot box. And it really took almost a year for it to be officially put on hold. It had been on hold since September of 2022. So in some ways, this isn't changing the status quo, but it is a major milestone for proponents of abortion access.
Noah, this was the culmination of a 5-year legal battle that actually started after DeWine signed the heartbeat bill in 2019. It's been a long process.
Yeah, it got enjoined when it was passed. Roe v. Wade was still the law of the land, so it was frozen in federal court. Then when the Dobbs decision overturned Roe v. Wade, the state went to a federal judge basically that afternoon and say, hey, unfreeze this law. And the judge said, okay, like with no notice. So then when it was re-enjoined or frozen or however you want to describe it, it was initially under the 2011 Healthcare Freedom Amendment to the Ohio Constitution.
That was an ironic twist in the story.
A post-Obamacare campaign of a dozen years or so that would try to stop any kind of single-payer system from coming here. In the interim, Ohio voters passed the new Abortion Rights and Reproductive Rights Amendment. And Judge Jenkins has been saying for months, oh, I'm going to issue my decision on this day. And then he strikes that schedule date and he says this day and this day. And if you read the opinion, you can see why, because what the attorney general said was, yes, we agree the 6-week ban at its core is unconstitutional under the amendment. But there's a lot of other stuff in here, and we don't think that's necessarily unconstitutional. And Jenkins goes through and analyzes all of them, and there are some that still stand because they created an adoption committee
right in
there and things like that. But there was also, in addition to the prohibition on performing an abortion after a certain time, there's a prohibition on performing one without having searched for cardiac activity and that kind of thing. You could still be fined. And, that's all laid out in the case.
Jake, the judge did not mince words in this ruling when he finally handed it down. He wrote that Attorney General Dave Yost, quote, evidently didn't get the memo that the Dobbs decision had returned the question of abortion access to the states.
Yeah. I read that line as I think there's almost frustration in that, you know, all lines of the Constitution are constitutional, but some seem less constitutional than others. You know, some are held very sacrosanct, and how dare you? You know, I think like the First Amendment, the Second Amendment are your classic examples. But then, you know, there's a point where the Constitution says what it says. I think a really plain reading of what voters enacted last year says women have right to reproductive health decisions of their own, and that has not been the case under Ohio law for, well, I should, that has not been what's on the books of Ohio law.
That's fair.
And I read just a certain amount of frustration of let's not complicate, let's not over litigate this issue. The amendment says what it says. It's just a little silly to try to explain how some of these very restrictive statutes comply and fit and jibe with the constitutional language.
If Dave Yost intends to appeal it, Jesse, then it'll go to appeals court. Eventually, it could make it up all the way up to the Ohio State Supreme Court. This is probably where the 24-hour waiting period before an abortion, whether I'll try to say this as simple as possible, whether admitting rights to hospitals are required. So there's a whole bunch of other cases that are still in the pipeline.
Yeah. So after Ohioans approved this measure, 57% of the vote last year, there were really two ways that it could go. Either lawmakers could start repealing their own laws. That was a non-starter from the beginning with the Republican-controlled legislature, or proponents of abortion access could start going to the courts. And so that's what they did. And they're kind of going systematically through these things. And eventually they could, several of these could reach the Ohio Supreme Court. Currently, the balance of the court is 4 Republicans and 3 Democrats. There are 3 seats up this year. So that's certainly a topic of conversation in those Supreme Court races.
We're sort of watching the incremental enactment of these abortion restrictions in reverse now, court case by court case, because it took a dozen or more years to build up all of these into law.
Kasich vetoed the heartbeat bill twice? At least once.
There was a lot of back and forth. I know around the time I first started at the State House, it was very divisive within the right to life community. Is this, you know, some of that was a disagreement about tactics, but you had legislative leaders and governors trying to stop it from moving. At one point, the bill was transferred from one committee to another because that resets the clock on discharge petitions, things like that. Lots of maneuvering.
Well, that's one of the remarkable things here, though, is if for people who have been paying attention or covering this stuff, like Noah has, you know, the heartbeat bill didn't just pass. These bills didn't just fall out of the sky. They were the products of years and years of concerted effort. And it's pretty remarkable how quickly the people who spent years of their lives passing these bills have suddenly said, you know, we just wanted the issue returned to the states and we don't really have all that strong of feelings and this isn't really our fight anymore.
I will say the Ohio Supreme Court race will be important because they will be hearing cases like this, possibly cases about gerrymandering, school vouchers, and that is my clever pitch for saying tomorrow on All Sides, you can hear from the 3 Republicans and 3 Democrats running for the state Supreme Court. Make sure to tune back in at 10 a.m. So the Democratic candidates for the Ohio Supreme Court have raised more than their Republican counterparts. Does that matter when there's an R or a D in front of their names? Or I guess it's after on the ballot, but still.
Split ticket voting is less and less common, but it still happens. It will probably decide the fate of Sherrod Brown, could decide the fate of some of these court races. It's hard to know what will cut through. Democrats are putting a lot of focus on the boneless wing decision or the not really boneless wings.
It's an easy to understand decision. I've seen TV ads for the Democratic candidates, like on my television. I was like, oh, okay, that's expensive this time of year.
Mm-hmm. So,
I don't know. I mean, does it matter? Yes, it matters. I think unavoidably it matters. I don't know if it's enough to defeat gravity here. You know, the Sherrod Brown math. I think he said that if Trump loses or Trump wins Ohio by 7 points or less, then he can win. So that's the margin he's looking at. So you have to assume for these Supreme Court candidates that just are not Sherrod Brown, that's got to be a
smaller margin.
Yeah, probably it's got to be a probably significantly smaller margin. So, I mean, does the money matter? Yeah, I looked, and this time last year, last cycle, when the 3 Republicans won, they went 3 for 3 and significantly outraising the Democrats. So this is new to see the Democrats with this kind of financial edge, but again, they're fighting gravity here.
As with a lot of these races, it's also not just what the candidates raise, but the outside money, outside entities on both sides are spending big.
And yeah, $2 million on each side.
And I think one of the most interesting of these 3 races is this 2 sitting justices who are facing off: Democrat Melody Stewart, Republican Joe Dieters, who was recently appointed by Ohio Governor Mike DeWine. Prior to that was Hamilton County Prosecutor. Stewart is really trying to make the case that she has significantly more judicial experience, which is true, and versus, you know, the power of having a Republican name behind your ballot. So that one will be really interesting.
Coming up, election turnout and why Ohio's attorney general indicted a dead man. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Candidates for November are set.
I know Donald
Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Saver. Still with me for our weekly reporter roundtable where we talk all things Ohio politics is Jesse Walmert, state government reporter. She also covers the governor for the Columbus Dispatch. Noah Blundo, reporter and editor for Hannah News Service. And Jake Zuckerman, state politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com. Attorney General Dave Yost called a press conference last week to announce he'd indicted six Ohioans for illegal voting. One of them, Ramesh Patel, died 2 years ago. Here's Yost at the press conference.
Let the message go out twofold. One is, if you're not a citizen, it is illegal to vote, whether you thought you were allowed to or not, and you will be held accountable in the state of Ohio. But the second is, this is a very small number of cases. Voting irregularities like this are rare. They're a small number. And you should rest assured, your Secretary of State flagged these cases and sent them to me. I took a look at them and I'm taking appropriate actions and enforcement.
Jake, how did the Secretary of State, Frank LaRose, and Dave Yost, who we just heard from, not realize that one of these six had died?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not sure I know the answer. What's clear, well, in the 40-minute press conference, Dave Yost never once mentioned that one of six people that he pursued charges and brought evidence to a grand jury about was dead. Now, they're saying after the fact, they won't answer reporters' questions of, well, did you know he was dead when you were bringing this evidence to a grand jury? They just say, of course, that we will drop the indictment. So the evidence points to, no, they probably did not know that this person was dead. So I think that the obvious conclusion here is that they did not interview this person, because had they tried to initiate an interview, the person would have died. And if you get into the weeds a little bit, Dave Yost went a lot in this, again, 40-minute press conference and explaining the concept of strict liability. And the takeaway is that it does not matter what a person's mind state, what their intent was when they were voting. The fact is, these people who were lawful permanent immigrants to the United States, they were authorized to be here by the government. They voted. They should not have voted, at least according to the state. Therefore, a crime was committed. I think that Dave Yost going into so much detail saying it does not matter what this person's intent was, again, just further signifies that they just did not know that this was a dead person. I'll add that Ramesh Patel was 68 years old. He was not the oldest person indicted. That would be a 78-year-old woman from Franklin County. So, again, I think the through line here is this was a press conference 2 weeks before an election day. This is from Dave Yost, who has political ambitions, probably statewide ambitions, one cycle from now. And yeah, one of six people indicted was dead.
Noah, like Jake said, they were legal residents. And there seems to be some confusion. I know Frank LaRose has talked about this in the past, of accidentally, I guess, from the BMV, giving them voter registration forms when they're getting their licenses, even though technically they shouldn't be filling them out, and that some of these cases are legit, like, not understanding.
Yeah, and there's, you know, there's a difference between registering when you shouldn't be allowed to be on the rolls and actually then going through and voting.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a distinction to be made there. And there's separate things going on right now about if you are a recently naturalized person, you know, what verification you need to provide that you are, in fact, now a citizen, whereas some recent records might state that you're not, and how you verify that. And the Secretary of State and the ACLU are in a disagreement about that right now.
And speaking of voting, Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose is suing Homeland Security to gain access to immigration records. So this story just came out this morning, so recognizing that we're all pretty new to it. But essentially, he's trying to get a better handle on this.
And he's been asking for these records for a while and has been rebuffed repeatedly. And so now he's turned to the courts. Yeah.
There's a rule of thumb that ignore stuff that happens so close to Election Day. It'll save you a lot of stress in life.
Jesse, let's talk about issue one, because there has been some reporting recently that the vote yes on issue one, that's the redistricting amendment for those who don't know. There's been three issue ones in the last year and a half, so it's a little confusing. But this is the campaign to change how we do redistricting. There's been some evidence, or at least anecdotal evidence, that people are confused when they're going to the ballot, that the state newsroom, the Ohio Public Radio, said that they found people who wanted to vote yes, but then they voted no because of the language on the ballot.
Yeah, I think this was part of, basically, people who are confused tend to vote no. That's kind of a maxim of statewide ballot campaigns and ballot campaigns in general. And so particularly the no side has been using things like stop gerrymandering when they knew the signs for the yes said ban gerrymandering. And so I think everyone knows that gerrymandering is like a bad thing that they want to stop, but like how do they go about it? I will say, like, in the most simple terms that I can explain, if you would like to change the current system and create a 15-member board of citizens who don't have like direct ties to politics to draw the maps in a way that kind of favors the statewide voting preferences, how people vote statewide, you should vote yes. If you like the current system that you think elected officials, a 7-member commission, should continue to draw the lines, lawmakers are being involved in the congressional maps, then you should vote no. Like, status quo, change it up.
This reminds me a little bit of the smoking ban campaign of 20 years ago when we had smoke-free Ohio versus smokeless Ohio.
It is. It is confusing. But I will say the Yes campaign, that's the Citizens Not Politicians campaign, has raised nearly $40 million since last September. Jesse, the bulk of that money came from out-of-state dark money. Probably don't know too much about where it comes from.
Yeah, I mean, generally it's a lot of like progressive groups, and out-of-state dark money is pretty prevalent in statewide campaigns. On the other side, which had significantly less money, you're seeing coming from dark money groups affiliated with conservative groups. Essentially, the premise being, if Ohio's maps are currently gerrymandered to benefit Republicans, any change to the system is going to benefit Democrats. And that's why Democratic groups, liberal groups are happy to spend money on this campaign.
Yeah. So, for example, of people we do know, U.S. Democratic House Leader Hakeem Jeffries donated $25,000 to the Yes campaign. Former Ohio GOP party chair Bob Paduchik, who is president of Agincourt Political Consultants, hope I said that correctly, he donated $70,000 to the no side. So
you're seeing people like the campaigns for Jim Jordan, Steve Scalise, Tom Emmer on the GOP side donating to the no side. You're seeing Hakeem Jeffries vote to the yes side. Unions, which typically but not exclusively benefit Democrats, have been donating to the yes side. So the money ended up about where you would expect.
And the control of the U.S. House of Representatives is going to turn on a handful of seats probably this fall.
Yeah. So. And I mean, Jim Jordan is in a pretty safe seat, even though he represents parts of suburban Columbus, like Delaware County, those places. Arguably, he may end up with a much more competitive seat in a reconfiguration of the state. So,
just to go off Jesse's framing here, though, I mean, you can kind of use that status quo, shake up the status quo, and apply that to the money, too. I mean, like the group, like the Ohio Oil and Gas Association, has given to the No One Issue One campaign. That's a group that has done pretty well under the status quo, and a shakeup to the status quo threatens that. Hakeem Jeffries, the Democrats, they've done pretty poorly under the status. You know, I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist here to see what's going on.
Speaking of, you know, status quo versus change, the last issue one, or maybe two issue ones ago, we had basically the same argument was, yes, maybe you don't like the current laws on abortion, or yes, maybe you don't like how we draw our maps right now, but this newfangled thing isn't the answer because XYZ. It's not right for Ohio. And that didn't work out for the no side on the last issue one, but we'll see what happens.
We'll know in a week.
Speaking of all these issue ones, there is a piece of legislation to change the numbering system, and I am not allowed to lobby the legislature, but just throwing it out there.
I too am not supposed to take positions on issues, but I would say perhaps this would clear up confusion.
I love it. I love having like 50 issue ones, and we have to specify which issue one we're talking about.
I think they might have passed that.
I hope so.
I'm racking my brain now. Mm.
Yeah, it's especially fun like when it was August issue one and November issue one. And, ha. Huh. Anyways, speaking of voting, we're going to stay on that for a little longer. I went and voted last week on Friday, and there was a sign on my machine that said, if you vote for Jill Stein, it will not count. Now, my understanding is Jill Stein is still, though, trying to get her votes counted in Ohio.
Yeah, so the Jill Stein campaign filed a lawsuit. This is a kind of interesting and windy story, but I'll try to keep it succinct. Basically, Jill Stein qualified for the Ohio ballot with a running mate named Anita Rios, who was really just a placeholder name. She ran for governor of Ohio a few years ago. And so the Stein campaign ostensibly was just going to keep that name on the ballot because the deadline to swap it out for the actual vice presidential candidate for the Green Party, Butch Ware, had already passed. The Ohio Green Party filed some paperwork with the Ohio Secretary of State's office to swap the names after that deadline passed. They seemed a little confused. She actually submitted a signature from Anita Rios that was copied and pasted from another document. Anita Rios says she never knew that this paperwork was going to be submitted. So you see how this is kind of messy.
It's, yeah.
Secretary of State's office said, well, it's too late to swap out the names, but if you want to take Anita Rios off the list, we can do that now. And you can't run without a running mate, and so the votes for Jill Stein don't count. The Stein campaign said, you know, we didn't get a heads up on this, so we should still have our votes count. But to your point, if you're voting via mail, you've received a piece of paper saying that votes for Jill Stein won't count. There's signs at the boards of elections, so already we've depressed what was already going to be a pretty small percentage of votes for the Green Party candidate Jill Stein.
But if we're wondering about top of the ticket margins and how that will affect other races, you know, a percent here, half a percent there, cast as a protest against this candidate or that candidate, you know, could have some significant down ballot effects.
Amelia Sykes, a U.S. representative of the Akron area, is also tangled up in election confusion. Jake, the elections board in Summit County deadlocked on whether she lives in her district or in Columbus. What's going on?
Yeah, this is one I'm only following from a distance, but her husband is a public official here in Columbus, and I believe that he marked her as cohabitating with him on a financial disclosure form of his, and Republicans up in Summit County are trying to use that document as a basis to say that she's not able to cast a vote here in Summit County, and there's a tie right now on boards of election are bipartisan, two Republicans, two Democrats, and the matter has gone to Frank LaRose. Has Frank LaRose decided yet?
I don't think so. Yeah, it's an interesting question because the argument that Sykes and her husband are making is they have two residents and they split their time between them, and he put her as living with him in an abundance of caution because she does live with him sometimes. But if they're living in two different homes and sort of going back and forth, then arguably, I guess, maybe they live in both. I don't know how you declare residency.
I wouldn't necessarily apply this to this case, but I believe the rule of thumb here is that voters get broad deference about where they live. You need a plausible conception.
Well, we'll be waiting to see. I mean, that's going to be a very close race, Jesse. And, you know, that is one of the seats that is vulnerable here for Democrats in Ohio. Marcy Kaptur is the other. And I think Greg Landsman down in Cincinnati is decently safe. I mean, we'll have to wait and see. He's the safest of the three, probably.
Ostensibly. And it's worth noting you don't actually need to live in your congressional district to represent
them.
It's not a requirement. But it is an issue that comes up literally every time someone lives close to a border or, you know, somewhere out of the district. So it's a frequent political point.
If you can jump back to issue one real quick, Senate Bill 98 passed right before the summer break. It was not initially about that, but it was amended in. So that is the law. This should be the last issue one.
For a long time.
RIP issue one.
Yeah, so if the $15 an hour minimum wage makes the ballot next year, it could be issue two, rather than restarting for every single election. I will note that Tuesday is the deadline for absentee ballot application. They have to be received by your Board of Elections by 8:30 p.m. Polls will be closed next Monday, the day before Election Day. So if you're going to early vote, you've got the rest of this week and the weekend. Monday is closed. Then Tuesday, you just go day of. Jake, let's talk a little bit about energy policy. Retiring House Majority Leader Bill Seitz said Republicans are too distracted by transgender bills. He said they can talk about boys in the girls' bathroom or whatever. Okay, that's all important, I guess, but it's not nearly as important as what we are talking about today. Interesting for the outgoing representative.
It's an interesting comment. It's very funny. Bill Seitz is
known for his quotable remarks.
He's funny. I mean, he is a brilliant orator, I guess the word would be. You know, he's just good at public speaking. I don't think it particularly matters which side of an issue he's arguing. He'll convince you. I'd add here that he was talking about the concept of re-regulating Ohio's energy markets. It's a pretty wonky issue. It's a pretty friendly argument to the utility companies. But I think there was an interesting point there that the issues that have real, especially since this internal Republican deadlock has really neutered the political capacity of the General Assembly to pass legislation. There's just been so much focus on transgender bills. You know, like even just seeding that the transgender health care bills is essentially a health care issue. So much focus is just on, you know, the five or so high school students who are transgender who participate in sports. The tail's been wagging the dog here. You know, it's just a culture war issue, and it gets people hopped up and divides everyone into neat little buckets. But is this really the most salient legislation the GA could be working on? I think self-evidently no.
And I'd also like to get a quick update from you on the Oil and Gas Land Management Committee. They have voted to open another 62 acres in Carroll County.
Yes, another 62 acres in Carroll County. That's going to go out to bid. That's like a 120-day or so process. There's some more interest in opening a couple thousand more acres at Salt Fork.
And this is for fracking and drilling.
This is for fracking and drilling. Salt Fork being a state park in Guernsey County that is under consideration. The interesting thing here is that, you know, if you remember a year or two ago, there was an issue where, to make a long story short, a front group for the oil and gas industry was submitting all these cookie cutter comments with real people's info saying, yes, please frack the parks. Since then, there was a media investigation. There was an attorney general investigation.
You say media investigation like it wasn't yours.
There was my media investigation. Thank you, Anna.
I just want to give credit where credit is due.
I appreciate that. It didn't lead to any civil penalties for the people doing it, but Dave Yost rolled out some new stricter laws for how these sort of public comments are submitted. And since then, I've only skimmed through, so I don't want to say every single one of them is opposing, but just at a skim, everyone I saw opposed the idea of developing these state parks. I'd say the smart money says all of them oppose the idea. This is not an idea with like a grassroots constituency behind it. And I think that's at least giving the OGLMC pause here. I struggle to imagine that they will still just totally cede to this public disapproval, but I think we have a much clearer picture now following that reporting and that investigation of what do people really think about this idea of frack in the parks. And it's at least giving the OGLMC pause.
That was Jake Zuckerman, state politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com. Thanks so much. And thanks to Noah Blundo, reporter and editor for Hannah News. And Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter with the Columbus Dispatch. Coming up, we're going to do something a little bit different. We are separating fact from fiction in the U.S. Senate race with a reporter from PolitiFact. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staber. Ohio isn't a swing state anymore, but our airways have still been inundated with political ads. Senator Sherrod Brown and businessman Bernie Miranda are spending millions upon millions trying to win our votes. And they're making a lot of claims. Joining us now is journalist Seth Richardson, a contributing writer for PolitiFact. He's also a journalism lecturer at the University of Minnesota. And if Seth's name sounds familiar, it's because he was formerly the chief politics writer for The Plain Dealer in Cleveland. Welcome to All Sides, Seth.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Let's start with how you rate claims at PolitiFact. So if you go to the website, there are truthometers, these little icons with arrows pointing to true or false or somewhere in between. And the arrow kind of indicates how true or false things are. How do you make those determinations from like partially true, mostly false?
Yeah, here at PolitiFact, we're very transparent about what goes into each of the claims and, into each of the ratings. So we also recognize that the truth is kind of a spectrum, right? I mean, things aren't all black and white. There's, you know, some people can say things that are partially true or, you know, mostly untrue, however you want to describe it. So we have this spectrum, and PolitiFact developed the spectrum of, you know, true being obviously the most true, the statement is accurate and there's nothing significant missing, to false, which is the statement is not accurate, to also include pants on fire, which means the statement is not accurate and makes a ridiculous claim. And, you know, what we do as reporters is we go through and we look at claims and we really try to be transparent with our sources as well. We make sure to post all of our sources so readers can see. We give both campaigns or both sides, whoever is making the claim, the chance to speak on whatever the claim is. And then we go through and we check the accuracy of it and sort of determine a rating based on a discussion that we have to determine, okay, is this half true? Is it, which would mean the statement is partially accurate but leaves out important details or takes things out of context? Or is this mostly true, which means the statement is accurate but needs clarification or additional information? So it really is a very deliberate process. I liken it to I hesitate to use this sort of analogy, but almost kind of a scientific method to it, where we really try to break it down into its essence and get to the root of the claim. Now, I want to caution that obviously rating checks is not a scientific process, but we do try to approach it that way, very clinical in nature.
55% of the Senate fact checks in this election, not the ones in Ohio, we're going to get to those in a moment, but all the ones done by political fact this election cycle, 55% of the Senate race fact checks have been false. I don't know what that says about politics. That one out of every two ads we see is not true.
Yeah, I don't know what it says about politics either. I guess it says something about people who are making the claims. That's really all we can go on is people are out here making these claims. And, you know, that's one of the core missions of PolitiFact is we want to be out there educating voters and making sure that they have the resources to determine what is true and what isn't true, especially when there are so many claims that are flying now. I mean, you're talking about races that are reaching in the, you know, more than $100 million, right? Even just, you know, 10 years ago, that was an absurd amount to really consider. So we really, you know, strive to get out there and say, okay, there are all these claims coming out. And we understand that, and I think this is true for all journalists, that we understand people need a resource to go to and determine, okay, is this actually accurate? Because when you hear these commercials, I think the first thing a lot of people do is say, wow, is that really true? And, you know, there can be these convenient little citations down at the bottom that, you know, might be true, or they might make it look more true than it actually is. So that's really kind of the core mission of PolitiFact.
Let's get into the ads in the Brown-Moreno race now that we kind of understand how it all works. Lately, there have been a lot of ads about their position on transgender children and athletes. So the Senate Leadership Fund, which is a Republican group, it's Mitch McConnell's fundraising group, has this ad saying that Sherrod Brown voted to allow what they describe as biological boys into girls' sports teams and locker rooms. You rated that claim as false. Can you walk us through the evidence?
Absolutely. So we reached out to the Senate Leadership Fund to get some more context on it. And if you look at the ad, there are citations for two votes that Sherrod Brown made, one of them in 2021, one of them in 2024. Now, if you go and you look at the votes, they are not on any bills that involve who is or is not allowed to play in sports, right? They are funding measures. And the amendments that he voted down in those funding measures, which failed basically along party lines, are what his campaign described as poison pill amendments. It's a term used to basically describe an amendment that is attached to another bill that is kind of designed to render it ineffective or kill it, in essence, right? It's also a way to sort of make people vote on controversial issues that maybe aren't totally germane to what the bill is about. So when we looked at these amendments, they involved essentially the amendments from Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama would have stripped funding from any Ohio school or university that allowed transgender athletes. Okay. So when we looked at this, it doesn't actually say who is or isn't allowed to play, right? Because who is eligible for athletics is determined by governing bodies, right? The NCAA, the OHSAA, all sorts of different governing bodies basically have a say in that. Whereas federal law around sports tends to deal with things like amateur status, things like that. So we looked at this and said, okay, it doesn't actually deal with who is allowed to play. It deals with funding. Which, you know, the Center Leadership Fund said, well, he voted for the funding, so that means he basically said, you know, allowed them to play via the funding. But, you know, when you're making those kind of, all right, you're jumping from here to another place, okay. You know, that's when it starts to get a little difficult. And, you know, the Brown campaign said that the reason that he voted against these were because, you know, it would have stripped Ohio schools of funding, and he wasn't going to vote for a bill that would strip Ohio schools of funding. So there hasn't actually been a vote specifically at the federal level about allowing transgender athletes to play.
The ad goes on to accuse Brown of allowing sex change surgeries and hormones for minor children. This one, you said, was a little more complicated.
Yeah, it is a little more complicated, although it does kind of there's a little more
nuance,
truth to it, I
guess,
yeah. So to speak. Nuance is a great word for it. There's a little more nuance to it, right? Again, not really. There's no vote on this matter. It stems from a bill that J.D. Vance introduced, basically it would have blocked gender affirming care for minors. The bill never got a vote. Right. The Senate Leadership Fund's claim stems from an appearance Brown had on the TV station escapes me right now, but on an Ohio TV station where he basically said he was against it because a child's health care decisions are between them, their parents, their families, and their doctors. He essentially was making the case that politicians should not be in the doctor's office, and it's not something that he agrees in. Now, that's a pretty.
Oh, I was just going to say, similar to his position on abortion access.
Correct. Yeah, it's one that we hear a lot, and this claim has actually been made in other states. Or similar claims have been made in other states as well, and so there's no vote on it. There's no, you know, legislation that moved forward on it. So there's nothing really on the record. But we did find that he was in support of he signed a letter, rather, basically urging the Biden administration to protect gender-affirming care. Now, gender-affirming care does include puberty blockers and sex change surgeries, right? However, it's extremely rare, and there's guidance on that, especially surgical intervention that is extremely, extremely rare on minors. So there is that little kernel of truth in there, but it's just blanketed by so much that, you know, we found to be inaccurate.
Let's move on to immigration. And I should say quickly that you can find all of the fact checks on Ohio at politifact.com, but also at WOSU.org this election. We have partnered with PolitiFact for this cycle, so you can find them on either website. Immigration has become a major campaign issue this election, and it's one where Republicans see an advantage, at least according to the polls. Moreno put up an ad claiming Brown helped give health benefits and stimulus checks to people in the country illegally. You rated that as false.
again, it comes back to some of these votes on you know, legislative process, or you call them maneuvers at times, right? But yeah, there just wasn't a whole lot of truth to it, because the underlying claim doesn't, you know, doesn't give you the context that you know, immigrants do not qualify for federal benefits kind of out of the gate.
Right? Yeah, you needed a social security number for a stimulus check.
Yes, you need social security numbers. You know, immigrants do generally do not qualify for federal health care subsidies, things like that. So what the Moreno campaign based this on was, you know, a series of votes that essentially kind of reaffirmed some of the things that were already legal, right? Or already law, I should say, rather.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, if he votes them down because he's, you know, it's going on during maybe a Votorama or something, which is essentially in budget bills where people just throw hundreds of amendments and they have to vote on them all before they pass. And if the, you know, the one that I found really interesting from this claim was about the migrants and federally subsidized healthcare, because, you know, I talked to an expert, Steve Smith, from the Weidenbaum Center on Economy, Government, and Public Policy at Washington University in St. Louis, and he said, in fact, this amendment that was put forth, it would have done absolutely nothing. So he was voting no on nothing when you kind of think of it that way. So, yeah, we found that misleading just based on, you know, this is already law. And if you're re-voting on something, it doesn't really give you the full context. So that is, you know, again, kind of how the process some of the process that we looked in that.
Abortion is another issue that's come up a lot. Senator Brown put an ad saying Moreno is for a national abortion ban with no exceptions. You rated this as half true.
Yeah, so my colleague, Kayla McCullough, he's great. He did the this check, but, you know, I'm familiar with it as well, and it kind of looked into it. And, yeah, it's half true, because when we talk about something that is half true, we're talking about something that is, you know, partially accurate, but it leaves out important details or maybe takes things out of context. So, you know, Sherrod Brown said that Bernie Moreno was now advocating for a national ban on abortion, right, which is true to a degree, that in 2022, Bernie Moreno, the Republican, did say he supported a ban on abortion, you know, 100%, no exceptions, right? That is not the case in 2024, in which he said that he thinks that there should maybe be limits, federal limits, after 15 weeks. He's got some carve-outs that he says he wants, namely for rape, incest, and risk of life to the mother. So it is accurate to say that he is advocating for federal limits, and that he has in the past, right? But it's not accurate to say that he is currently saying that there should be no exceptions whatsoever.
It's also complicated, because I think this gets into the question of what is in somebody's heart or their mind, because I'm sure there are listeners now who would argue that Moreno is just acting more moderate on abortion to get elected. That's not what he really believes. But when it comes to fact-checking, you can only go by what they've said.
Which is why we really stay away from using the term lie. We're very careful about that, because it's difficult to know, you know, what someone's, you know, intent is, right? Because you can be inaccurate and just misspeak, right? Now, yeah. I'm not saying that's what happened here, but that is absolutely what could be the case. So we really avoid the term lie or intent or anything like that, and really focus down on, okay, what are the facts of this? Let's just look at the facts here, because we want people to be able to make a decision based on the facts.
Only 3% of the PolitiFact fact checks this year for Senate races have gotten a special designation that gets close to lie: pants on fire. Obviously coming from the liar, liar, pants on fire taunt that we all learned as children. Bernie Moreno got a pants on fire icon in mid-September for continuing to push the unfounded narrative that immigrants in Springfield were stealing and eating pets.
Yeah, this is one of those, again, for your listeners. The pants on fire is used to denote a claim that is not only false, but kind of ridiculous. It makes a ridiculous claim. And, you know, obviously it a lot of it stems from, well, the origin of it comes from a Facebook post in which the woman had zero firsthand accounts of anything. And it's since said as much that she just heard it from someone who heard it from someone who heard it from, you know, basically a game of telephone, I guess, for your younger listeners, it would be, I don't know what the equivalent would be. But, you know, so we looked at this and, you know, basically he said, yes, that, you know, Haitian immigrants were eating pets in Springfield, Ohio. But, you know, there's actually more that is inaccurate to this claim, which is that the Haitian migrants are here illegally.
Correct.
Right? Which is also not true.
Yes.
They are here on a humanitarian parole program for aid. And the other part of the claim that wasn't true is sort of laying the blame at Sherrod Brown. The Haitian migrants were allowed here from, you know, by the Biden and the Harris administration through the Department of Homeland Security. Sherrod Brown didn't have anything to do with that. He's not part of that decision-making process.
Gotta end it here. We're up at the end of the hour. You can find all of his fact checks at PolitiFact.com or at WOSU.org. Seth Richardson, a contributing writer for PolitiFact, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.